Hello, Gareth. We're back with Projector Room. You all right?
Oh, yes. Sorry for the delay. It's entirely my fault. Things broke. Things broke on Linux Mint quite badly. So I'll gibber on about it in Tech Alex if you want to tune into that next week.
On Sunday, yeah. Tech Addicts is here on Sunday, but we are coming to you a day late. Not that anyone will notice. Not that anyone last night said, where's the podcast then? Because, frankly, probably no one listens to it. However, we can say what we like, can't we? We can say what we like about who, because no one's listening.
Or it could be more to the fact that they know that we're generally bit tardy whenever it comes to timekeeping.
Yeah. This is show 216 anyway, and we're coming to you on Thursday, the 13th of August, and we will bring you a show with lots of interesting stuff, hopefully. First up is feedback from our group and Chad Dixon on The Call, which is a Netflix film on 2013 film. The Call is a compact, high-tension thriller starring Halle Berry as Jordan Turner, an LAPD 911 dispatcher. The story kicks off with a traumatic event. Jordan takes a call from a teenage girl hiding from an intruder. A tragic misstep leads to the girl's murder, leaving Jordan plagued by PTSD. 6 months later, while conducting a tour for new recruits, another high-stakes emergency hits the call center floor. A teenager named Casey has been snatched from a mall car park. That's a shopping center, drugged and thrown into the boot of a moving car. Luckily, she finds a discarded burner phone in her pocket and dials 911. When the rookie dispatcher begins to panic under pressure, Jordan takes over the desk, forging a frantic connection with Casey, while LAPD officers, including Jordan's cop boyfriend, race to trace the untargeted phone across Los Angeles. Clocking in at just over 90 minutes, this 15-rated thriller keeps you on the edge of your seat as the violence and panic progressively ramp up. Berry and Breslin, that's Abigail Breslin playing Casey, deliver exceptionally strong performances, making the remote bond between dispatcher and victim feel completely genuine. It's a gripping one-hit watch that is well worth queuing up on the sofa with your favourite snacks. This is the kind of thing that I reckon you have already watched. It seems like we've done some of these kind of dispatch centre thingies before, haven't we? I can't remember any of the names of them now, but we both have watched these, haven't we?
It was the Guilty, wasn't it? That was the
Remake
as well, with Jake Gyllenhaal. Yes, I have seen this. I think I might have been in the cinema to see this in 2013. Yeah. Wow. I don't remember it particularly well, but I do remember coming away from it going, that was cool. And it was just one of those kind of flash in the pan thrillers that was quite strong, a bit like, I don't know, Phone Booth or Cellular or one of those sorts of films. Or Breakdown is another one. That, you know, it's not an amazing thriller that's going to sort of reinvent the genre, but it's just a really good example of a well thought out script, well performed and exciting. And I remember the rousing climax under a bridge or something, or something with that made me think, yeah, this is going places I like. You know, it's not taking the cheeky way out where they're, you know, because it's a not a claustrophobic thriller, but, you know, a particularly linear thriller, it could, you know, cheap out and do something quite poor for a climax, especially in that it wasn't a big budget film. But it really delivered some top-notch thrills along the way and a gripping storyline. So nice one, Chad. Good recommendation for the folks.
Good call.
Well, Phil Harding has watched Hello, Mary Lou, which is known as Prom Night 2, I think, here, or it's Prom Night 2, Hello, Mary Lou in the States or something like that, from 1980. This was surprisingly effective, if very dated. It looks like a VHS transfer, so it's weird where he might have watched it. It's basically a Carrie knockoff where the prom queen from the 1950s comes back to possess a social outcast in the 1980s setting. Michael Ironside stars as the jilted date, who now runs a school. Something I liked about this was one of the authenticity of the time period. We're so used to seeing highly stylized depictions of the 1980s with thumping synth soundtracks and garish clothes. It feels authentically drab. I quite like Prom Night series. I haven't seen them all in a while. The first one starred Jamie Lee Curtis and was a bit of a... It's not one of the most highly thought of slasher movies of the late 70s in the wake of Halloween and before Friday the 13th. But yeah, the four films in the franchise are worth checking out. I don't think they're connected. It's one of those series like House where... They don't have a particular unique storyline that goes through each of the films, but they're just, you know, similarly themed and titled that way. If memory serves, I need to watch them again. I'm waiting for a 4K box set to arrive, because, you know, like Psycho and The Omen and things like that, they're kind of best served up like that, where you get them all. So it'd be interesting, Phil, if you watch the rest of the series. And let us know where you watch this, because I think I have it on DVD, but is it on streaming? I don't know.
It's on Shudder, because this one that is coming up now is the second in Phil's trilogy of Shudder highlights. And his second one is Jacob's Wife from 2021. This is a suburban vampire story starring Scream Queen Barbara Crampton from Reanimator. A bored vicar's wife is seduced into a sorority of lady vampires who are fed up with guys making all the decisions for them. Surprisingly, her husband is pretty okay with her transformation and turns out to be a dab hand at vampire hunting. There's some icky body horror along the way, and the vampires look pretty cool. Think Fright Night, says Phil. My only criticism is that it's not too clear whether it wants to lean into the comedy or horror, which might irk some viewers like me. But overall, I think it works, and Crampton is superb. I haven't seen that, but I like vampire stuff, as you know, so I might. Your turn.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. I haven't seen this either, but I'm a massive fan of Barbara Crampton. She can do no wrong in my eyes. I love her. Yes. But then okay. So does every man. The Untamed is another one that he's watched recently. And I'm just looking at this. This is one that I've been trying to track down. I didn't know it was on Shudder. Thanks, Phil. I will investigate. By far the pick of the bunch. This is a Mexican sci-fi horror about a tentacled alien which gives pleasure to humans. Sorry. the catch is that it can sometimes get a bit rough. A dissatisfied and sexually frustrated young woman is introduced to said alien by a new acquaintance. It turns out that having sex with an alien is not a consequence-free as consequence-free as she thought. It's an engrossing film, similar in tone to Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson. Recommended. And I can see from the note below that Ted has run at full speed to watch this.
I did watch
tell
this.
Tell us about it, you dirt bird.
Well, my first observation is that, well, firstly, it's in whatever language they speak in Mexico. Is it Spanish or Portuguese?
Portuguese-ish, yeah.
So it's all subtitled. But the first thing I would have to say about it is that for the first hour of the film, nothing really much happens. It feels a bit like a soap opera about these families in Mexico and a girl in Mexico that's finding her way and blah, blah, blah. Teenager, young married mum, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, after about an hour in, it just takes off completely. And the rest of the film is this bonkers body horror thing, sci-fi thing about this tentacled alien. And I have to say, there's one scene in it that is just amazing. They've got this this actress into this situation with this multi-tentacled alien, and nothing at all is left to the imagination. You just see, and she is in orgasmic delight throughout the whole scene, and it goes on for a few minutes. And you know, be careful if you go to the cinema to see it, because you'll need a box of tissues probably. It's very it's incredibly erotic. Like, it's been really, really well directed and shot, and yeah, it's just like a really, really erotic scene, but with this alien in the mix of it, doing this stuff to this woman. But apart from that, yeah, it does turn out in the end to be quite well done and well. Although I will say that I wasn't expecting the film to end either. It felt as though it hadn't ended, and then suddenly, dung, the credits were there. So there was that as well. But yeah, it's definitely worth seeing, if for nothing else, for that one erotic scene.
All right, forget the rest of the podcast. I'm going to watch this. See you later.
Yeah.
Phil, if you fancy it, this does sound something similar to Possession, with Sam Neill and Isabella I can't remember her name. But yes, give that a go, because it might be something similar. That's why I was looking for this initially.
Okay, cool. Anyway, thanks for your Shudder trilogy, Phil. That's great. We'll make sure that the links for all that are in the show notes. Flop of the fortnight time, and I have nothing. Have you got anything?
Oh, loads, loads. And there's another one I could add on as well, but I'll maybe save it for next time.
Okay.
All right. Well, because my son is really into Planet of the Apes and he enjoyed the new series, we're going back and watching the old series, and I'm sure you can see where this is going. Obviously, the original Planet of the Apes from 1968, I think it is. I'm going to go with that. Is a classic, and it sets up quite the universe for them to explore, although Charlton Heston didn't want to explore it and felt that the story was done by the time it came to an end with a great climax. But it was a major, major hit at the box office, so they made a sequel or two. And I'm going to address the first sequel, which was Beneath the Planet of the Apes, a film that I was really excited about watching when I first found out about it, primarily because the title is very different for a sequel. And it kind of inspired quite the imagination of a young me whenever I wanted to watch this. And it was at a time when it wasn't readily available. You know, I remember watching the original Planet of the Apes, I think, with my dad or maybe my brother. I can't remember which. But Beneath the Planet of the Apes was not able to be... You can't just click it up and cue it for the next film. So I had to wait a number of months, years, weeks, days, I don't know, whatever it was, until I got to see it, by which time I was trying to imagine Beneath. Ooh, does that mean they go into tunnels? Is there Morlocks and things like that underneath, you know, thinking of the time machine or something? What's down there? And when it eventually arrived, I was really disappointed. And watching it again, I thought, I'll give that another go, because I do like James Franciscus. I think he's a really quality actor, because he takes over the lead role from Charlton Heston, who didn't want to do it. But they brought Charlton Heston back for a smattering of the runtime. He's in there a little bit. It takes the great twist of the ending, and it tries to push on with it by... It's a film very much in two halves, if you excuse this, Ted. Sorry, I know what's coming up later on, but I can't help but suggest this here. It's a film in two halves where the first half is pretty much the same as the first film and retreading. And then the second half is where they actually go beneath the Planet of the Apes, and it all goes a bit bonkers. The second half is pretty insane, which involves a group of people. It kind of takes the focus away from the apes being the antagonists into these other mutated humans who have telepathic powers, and they're badly mutilated, and they worship a nuclear bomb, and they sing, what was it, all things bright and beautiful to the bomb. And yeah, that's grand, and I know that games like on TV shows like Fallout have taken inspiration from this, but you know that's not what I came to see. And given that you know you've just sat through a retread only to enter into something that isn't a Planet of the Apes movie, you're a bit kind of miffed as to what is this film. I know there's a very huge anti-war message throughout it, and I think that mainly comes from Charlton Heston. That was his reason for doing it, because he wanted to get that across. And it's got a real bummer of an ending to ensure, like in that Harrison Ford Han Solo kind of way, that that he won't have to do things like this again. But you know, it's an ending that doesn't resolve anything. It's annihilation, and that's crazy. And if anything, it's one of those sort of endings that you think, hang on a second, they got three battle, conquest, and I think there's three more in the original series. I think there's five in total. But yeah, I can't remember the name of the other. But they got sequels out of this, considering what happens at the end of Beneath. And it just made me think, this is such a crap movie. It really is. The special effects are bad. The plot device to bring James Franciscus in to kind of take over the lead role from Charlton Heston is so ham-fisted. It's painful. You know, it's a case of another astronaut gets out of a crashed ship, and you're like, wow, they put so much effort into the crash ship and how the ship crashes in the first film. They're just going to forgo that, you know, forget about it. Just, there he is. He's emerged. Someone else is dead. Right, grand. And then they move on. And it's like, it has absolutely no respect for the audience and the people who supported and made the original film such a hit. It really feels like such a cheap, rushed, derivative, ridiculous and uneven sequel to a great movie that's just there as a cash grab. Have you seen Beneath?
Yeah, I've seen all of them. And I think I agree with you on this one. It's been quite a while since I watched the five right the way through, but when I watched this one, I remember thinking the same as you, that the first half was kind of half decent, and then it just became such a stupid storyline that it wasn't worth watching the second half of the film at all. It just became completely daft. I honestly can't remember the ending you're talking about, but I do remember enough of it to know that I agree with you, and it was a bit of a flop. But I don't want to put any Planet of the Apes films in Flop of the Fortnight, really, because I think that the whole genre is really interesting, and even if some of them are not as good as others, I think the whole thing is just quite engaging, and it's worthy of not being in Flop of the Fortnight. So I tell you off.
Well, you know, I suppose I could take it out because I would give them a lot of credit for the title. You know, I know that's the really limp way of doing it, but, you know, it's not Planet of the Apes 2 or Planet of the Apes Strikes Back or something like that. They actually, it's a bit like Quatermass and the Pit. It's one of those titles where you're like, whoa, what happens there?
Well, if you've been paying attention at the end of the first one, you'd know what Beneath means. Spoiler alert.
As a child, I was really excited to imagine. It's not that I didn't know what it was. I just, you know, it's the imagination of what could be there.
Yeah, okay.
And now I look at it and I was kind of watching it going, you know, Futurama did this better.
Fair enough. But no, crap it might be, but as part of the series, the franchise, it's not.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough. I will fight that it I'm hoping it's the worst of the series. I don't think it is. I remember one of the other ones being really tacky and TV movie values. But yeah. I'll carry on watching them and bring reports to the show as to how I find them.
Okay.
The other film that I watched was Disclosure Day. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing between people, and some people love it and some people hate it. I didn't get on terribly well with it. And I think it's because it's Spielberg, I expected more. I expected more because there's actually too much in it for it to. I actually made a little list of the ridiculous amount of stuff that they try to cover in this one movie instead of, you know, this would have been a much better mini TV series or something like that, because there's so many themes that they try to get through. And the writer, David Koepp, who's great, don't get me wrong, he has just put far too much in this, and they've just condensed it all down. I think the whole film suffers because it would have been better had it been stretched out. And given that the cast isn't particularly stellar or anything, you know, it's not full of big names like Harrison Ford and Richard Dreyfuss and the usual ones that Spielberg tends to draw in. It's got a smaller, more humble cast. I think this could have been stretched out into a really good limited series of maybe four or five episodes, because it does, it covers UFO cover-ups, government experimentation, mysterious defense contracts and things, whistleblowing, childhood alien encounters, psychic abilities, alien languages, trauma, media manipulation, religious implications, human capacity for empathy, and impending international crises, all in the one film. And it's just like, wow, what have we done here? And the film doesn't quite know what it is. It has elements of humor, which is quite good. That really helps along the way, but there's not enough to keep you going because most of the characters are pretty damn bland. There's action moments which are exciting at the time, but you know the scope of them just doesn't feel quite right. There's a big sequence where they're escaping onto a train, and it feels like they maybe borrowed it from another film that they couldn't quite get it into. So they thought, well, we need a bit of excitement at this point during the film, so let's throw that in. It doesn't need to be there. It is merely there just to, push a bit of excitement onto the audience, because this isn't an action adventure or anything. It's just a sci-fi escape movie. And they've thrown in a few action sequences just to be right. And then you compare this obviously to other films that Steven Spielberg have done of this ilk. You've got Close Encounters and War of the Worlds and E.T. And those three films are vastly superior to this in every way, and you can't help but draw comparisons. In a way, I was hoping that this might actually be some kind of carry-on from one of those films, where it was like a faux sequel, or he was tapping into it, because I think whenever they were making, was it Close Encounters, they called it something like Night Skies, to try and hide the fact that it was being made, so that they didn't speculate that it was going to be E.T. 2 or something like that. So I think he could have tapped into something like that just to really reward the viewers. But no, I walked away thinking, you know, It was actually kind of boring. It wasn't exciting. It was annoyingly trite along the way, and it didn't thrill me in the way that I really wanted it to. It pains me to say that because I'm such a big Spielberg fan, but you know he has to have a misfire. He's had a few of late, but this was just another one that I don't think he's really put as much love and effort into it. And he doesn't have to. He has a great body of work. But this just felt like he was churning something out to satisfy studios or to renew his insurance or something like that for being a film director. Don't know. And the CGI was quite weak, considering this was a Spielberg movie where he usually has groundbreaking CGI. Yeah. Have you seen this at all?
I have, and so has Adrian Brame. We highlighted his thoughts on a previous show. But so I'll put a link to his review in the notes. I think generally you're right, and Adrian tended to agree, although he was a bit less executioner-like than you. I can't think of the word. I did think that Emily Blunt was good in the lead. I thought that Colin Firth's role was just ridiculous. He was just that whole, his character was just it was just really badly written, and he was just not at all convincing in what he was supposed to be. So that spoiled it for me. The other thing I would say is that I watched this, I can't remember when, a few weeks ago, and looking at the trailer running through just now, I had to be reminded about everything that was in it, pretty much. Yeah. The point being that it was instantly forgettable, and I very successfully instantly forgot about it. So, yes, I think I would probably agree with you on this, and Adrian would as well, to a large degree, but maybe not as such a large degree as you.
Yeah, it is just a case of being let down. And I was looking at it there, and I noticed that, yeah, the AI stuff that they used as well for recreating the likes of the, well, I suppose it is CGI really, but the likes of the footage that the government has and they release is woefully done. You know, it does not feel like, you know, this is footage from the Roswell crash. It feels like someone has created AI footage and dumped it on Twitter or TikTok as footage from the Roswell crash that people can quite easily go, nah, that's not it. So there you go. That'll do.
Right. Okay. So Disclosure Day in Flop of the Fortnight is a bit more of a universal agreement. Fandom Focus is next, and it's your turn to bring something to this. So what are you going to thrill our listeners with?
Well, I'm going to go back to something that I visit quite frequently because, you know, I get renewed faith every now and again whenever something exciting comes along. And I love my Italian poliziotteschi thrillers. You know, they are cop movies from Italy in the 70s and 80s, or 60s, 70s and 80s. And I was trying to, you know, just work out exactly what it is I love about them. And I suppose it comes from the point where I used to watch them because they were really cheap to buy on video back in the 80s. I was able to pick up, you know, five for £5 or whatever from somewhere that was selling ex-rental VHSs. And my friends and I would sit around and we would just enjoy sort of the silly spectacle of, you know, there was all these Fiats and Alfa Romeos and things and Citroen DSs crashing through windows and, you know, barbaric car stunts and things. There was a little bit of nudity here and there, maybe a bit of roughing up a young lady and having their way with them or slapping them around, you know, which is very much frowned upon now, but, you know, it very much existed then and there's no ignoring it. But you also had tough plot lines and tough characters, you know, really Dirty Harry-esque protagonists, cops and detectives and gangsters, anti-heroes and those sorts of things who were rarely squeaky clean or whatever, but they were very compelling to watch. The action was brutal. There's shootouts and kidnappings and assassinations, robberies and fisticuffs in the street, fisticuffs on the bonnets of cars, raw stunt work. And that's one of the things that really draws me to it. Very, very over the top villains as well, who are, you know, generally played by fading star American actors, you know, like Jack Palance or someone like that, or Telly Savalas, who aren't quite making it in the American cinema scene. So they go out to Italy. It's all addressed in Rick Dalton, Leonardo DiCaprio, that kind of thing from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Really cool soundtracks that follow films. You know, you could be watching a film and go, I know this music. Ah, they just borrowed the music from that film and stuck it in there because it's a lot cheaper than going and getting a new composition written. And there can be something, they can go from really funky 70s foot tapping, you know, Rocky music to a proper orchestral score or something synthy in the same film. And I just love that kind of unevenness because it's really cheap filmmaking, where they're focusing their money on, you know, spectacular practical stunts or those sorts of things. And then there's the dubbing. And I think this is the main thing. Whenever I was younger, the dubbing was just funny. Because across Westerns and all sorts of things, when I was watching them, it just entertained me that, you know, it never matched up. And Hong Kong action movies and things like that never matched up as well. So dubbing was something that could just be a bit of a lampoon. And I know that there are films like What's Up Tiger Lily and things like that take that to the nth degree. But whenever you see it actually happening and it's supposed to be taken seriously and it doesn't quite work, it's just fun, you know, especially when you're sitting with your mates and having a beer. And, you know, each country had their own go at it. If you look through the bowels of history, you'll see that, you know, Spain had some of these as well. France had a go. Italy was doing really well. They were cranking out these movies like crazy because, and I know I've talked about this before, but at the time in Italy, they only had two TV channels. They were only allowed to show one film a week. It couldn't be at the same time. So pop-up cinemas was a big way forward. And there was thousands of cinemas all over Italy, small cinemas that needed content to be played. So going out to the cinema was a nightly thing for people in the way that we would sit down and watch The Bill now or The Cape Fear or something like that on Netflix. People would actually go out and they would sit down and watch a movie in the theater with their friends and family. So it was a very social thing that has fallen away. It sounds amazing. I would love to be there for that. So they constantly needed to have local content that they could put out. And then anything that was quite good, they tried to sell to America and the odd one would go on, like Django would go on and just, it would hit big and be released all across America, and those people would go on to make huge amounts of money. And if that happened, then you get a load of knockoffs of it where the name was used again because of their copyright. It's a whole thing, a whole channel that you go down that you can't help but find fascinating, or at least I can't help but find fascinating. It's just great. It's entirely different to the American cinema system, to the British cinema system, everywhere else in the world. And whenever you start getting into it, you realize just how much and how rich of a world it is. And it's becoming really popular. And I'm loving that because so many of these films are being treated with the respect that they deserve. And they're being taken and cleaned up and put back out on 4K. It's hard to believe. There's a 4K of Weapons of Death sitting right beside me. That's unbelievable. I had that film on VHS. No, I didn't. Actually, I tell a lie. I didn't have it on VHS at all. But it's a film that I haven't seen for a long, long time. And it's just gone from ropey and tattered to pristine, but still retaining the grit and the look that was just so genre-making at the time. You're not a big fan of Italian action movies, are you, from the 1970s?
Well, whenever you've kind of put one of these things in the show previously, I've kind of looked at some of them and think, I just look and think, this is just so dated and it's just so badly acted and the dubbing is crap. And I think from Phil, you see, you're going into this, fair enough, in fandom focus, and you can do this because you're a fan. But most other people, well, not most other people, but an awful lot of people like me expect more polish and more production values and their entertainment to be something special and great and well done. And these things almost feel as though they're purposely trying to make them not well done, and thereby creating some culture and some cult following, and it just it just all seems stupid to me and daft and pointless to try and make films in this kind of way. But yeah, I mean, each to their own, and I respect you that you're a fan, and I'm glad that you enjoy the stuff. What does that word mean anyway? Polizia
Listio Tetchi.
Ceci.
I pronounced that badly as well. It is just a label that was put to it. It does have a meaning, but I don't think the meaning translates very well into English. It's a bit like giallo. You know, giallo is a genre now, of a type of thriller movie that features like a cloaked man with a knife. A bit like a slasher film, but it's not a slasher film. It's quite difficult to actually, you know, put your finger on exactly what it is. And people argue that this should be one and this should not be one and that sort of thing. But Poliziotteschi is kind of just a cop action movie that's inspired by the likes of Dirty Harry or Death Wish or something like that. That was made in spaghetti western. That's a perfect example. Spaghetti westerns
Oh, right. Here
are.
we go. Here we go. Polizia is the Italian noun for police. So the
Yes.
first part of his word means police. Esco means esque or in the style of. So basically, it looks like it's films in the style of Italian police.
I think it's the other way around, where it's Italian police films that are in the style of, and then the genre, which is like cop movies from America. You know, it's if you were to extrapolate that into it's a knockoff of bigger films that do this possibly better, like Dirty Harry, if that
Definitely
makes
better.
sense. But then spaghetti westerns are, you know, westerns that were made in Italy. That's also
Yeah.
known as spaghetti cop movies, I think, or
Okay.
something like that. I can't remember all the terms, but
But spaghetti westerns made in Italy that we know so well just seem to be done better somehow than these ones that I've watched that you put me onto previously, which just look stupid and daft and pointless. But then you're also, you see, I'm happily invested in the kind of Western genre, but I'm not particularly invested like you are in police dramas, which you are. So there's that as well, which turns me off of all this, because if it's all about police dramas and action police things, then I'm less interested to begin with.
But then it, as a genre, it's one of those things that gets changed over time. You know, if you look at the Italian output, in the late 50s, they were doing all gladiator movies and things like that, ran into the 60s. Then, you know, westerns were happening and they kind of moved from gladiator sword and sandal movies to the spaghetti western. And then, you know, the likes of Dirty Harry and Death Wish came along. So focus moved from the Western to the cop action movies, and then to Star Warsy type movies and zombie movies. So, you know, they're producing things, and there is kind of a clear heyday of the Italian knockoffs going out at a particular point. But if you look at that particular point of say the late 60s to the late 70s, whenever they were making these Poliziotteschi movies, they kind of get they start off really strong, where you've got like Caliber 9, which is one of the best examples of a Blitzy Testy cop crime movie. And it's absolutely superb. And as they go along, that, you know, comedy starts to come in. And, you know, Tomas Milan made a whole rake of comedy movies, and Terence Hill and Bud Spencer all started going in it. And it becomes harder for people to find things that are good to watch. There still are some gems in there, but, you know, you've got the comedy coming in, and that's whenever you can almost see the end of that genre being popular, because it gets stupider and stupider, and then boom, Star Wars arrives, and they move into trying to make sci-fi movies, or Mad Max as well. And the early ones are very affectionately copycats of what it was. So you end up getting a better movie, and it gets worse as it goes along. So the later ones are generally less well thought of, but it is kind of it's guerrilla filmmaking. They ran out for a week and went and made a film, and then got it released in cinemas just to get a payday. There's not much thought that goes into it. We've got a camera and we've got some cars. Let's film a police action movie, and they do that. And you know, it's the same thing that happened with El Mariachi. Whenever Robert Rodriguez went out and made that, he just went guerrilla filmmaking, made a Mexican standoff movie, essentially, with a guy with a guitar case full of guns. And then he got a calling card from Hollywood to go and remake it as Desperado with Antonio Banderas. And it was one of the biggest movies of the year. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's the track that these things follow. And it all starts out with just, you know, a really good film that does well, like Caliber 9, that everyone wants to mimic and try to get a piece of that action. And some of them do them really well, some of them don't, but you can get different things out of them. Like I love Maurizio Merli, who's a film star that looks a bit like Franco Nero. So they dumped him in a load of these Blitzio Testi movies. He passed away at an early age, so he didn't make too many movies, but it's enough that, you know, they're competently made, they're action packed. He is cool. And, you know, it's never going to win any awards, but whenever you sit down on a Thursday night after a rough day's work, and you just open a bottle of beer, it's what you want to see, because it's got all those things: insane car chases, brutal action, a tough protagonist, great villain, urban atmosphere, wonderful soundtrack, fashion, style, cars, all that kind of stuff. It's brilliant. Love it. Can't get enough of it. Let's move on.
Right. Okay, well, I'm glad it's in fandom focus, because all those things you just described completely switched me off about a film. But there you go. Let's move into private screening, in which you were responsible, or was it me?
No, it was me.
Yeah, you were responsible for picking something for us to watch, so lead that away in the Gareth Projector Room show.
Well, you know, you picked Little House on the Prairie, so I needed to sanitize my Western needs with something that looked really good. And Frontier Crucible is one from Travis Mills, and it's directed by Travis Mills and stars Miles Clothesy. I don't know him at all, to be honest. It's got Tom Jane in there, who I'm a huge fan of. Armie Hammer, who I'm not a huge fan of, William H. Macy has a wee cameo at the start to get the film going, and Mary Strickley. It's based on a novel from 1961 called Desert Stakeout. I thought it was actually a really decent Western. It's not fabulous, but it's really decent. It's an absorbing 2 hours of exterior Western. This is something that really I noticed about it, is that none of it takes place indoors. It's all out in a particular watering hole in the surrounding areas of the desert. I can't remember whereabouts it was set, but, you know, it's
Arizona.
Arizona, was it? I thought they were heading down towards New Mexico. So
they were. It was Arizona was where they got stuck.
Right. Okay. Well, it's very arid as it is. I guess the pacing is something that people are not going to really enjoy unless you love your slow moving westerns, because it is a slow moving western. It's kind of talky. There's a wee bit of action here and there. There's a few shooty uppy bits, but not terribly much. It's quite violent from here and there, but I'd say that violence is somewhat realistic, and they've tried to capture that on a very limited budget. And it plays out as an enthralling story of a tete-a-tete between five people out in the desert, and yet it continues to be interesting and entertaining throughout. It reminded me a wee bit of Kurt Russell's Bone Tomahawk, which was a very, very good western, very brutal. It's nowhere near as brutal as that. You could watch this with family, but I would say that you're probably going to have to maybe ask them to cover their eyes in the last few minutes. But some of the characters don't tend to be as violent as I expected them to be, because I was thinking that one of the particular characters was quite savvy, and felt like he was going to be some sort of great pistolman, and there was going to be a great showdown between him and the leading character, but it didn't actually come to pass, and it just turned out he was a well-spoken and well-dressed antagonist that was a wee bit psychotic, but never actually managed to exhibit those psychotic t bits that he would normally do, personality bits, being a psychotic. But my main love from the film was Tom Jane gave an absolutely superb performance. He was quite witty, quite slimy. But also you wanted him to be a wee bit noble, which he sort of comes across, and I just felt it was a really nice character, and I can understand why he was quite happy to do this, because it's a really rich and interesting character for him to play. I really enjoy this film. I'm not going to put it up at the top 10 westerns of all time or anywhere close to it, but it was an agreeably enjoyable 2 hours of, I think it was 2 hours. It was nearing 2 hours of Western fun out in the desert that you just enjoy. There's no big plot twists or anything like that to shock you along the way. It is just a story that plays out in that Western kind of way, and it reminded me of the Westerns of the 70s, especially The Score. It felt very 70s Western. Ted, what did you make of it?
Well, it was. I tend to agree with most of what you said, really, except that I'm marking it down because of that slow pace of it all, and it was just too slow. And there's a large section in the middle of the film where nothing really happens much, and it's just very, as you said, very, very talky, talky, talky. And the dialogue's not that good. The people that were supposed to be the Mr. Nasties were not really very nasty. They weren't very convincing. I didn't think that generally the acting was that good. The guy who plays Merrick, they just seem to have tried really hard to make him a Clint Eastwood character, and that just came across so strongly all the time. Everything he did, all his movements, all his looks to camera, all his just everything about him was Clint Eastwood, and that was just annoying that they just nicked that, I suppose. But it was an okay story. Apart from that, it was fine. There was a bit of tension growing as we got towards the finale. Incidentally, I discovered through research that the reason that the ending suddenly erupts is because uncredited on the script was S. Craig Zahler, who is indeed the writer director of Bone Tomahawk and your other favorite, Dragged Across Concrete. So the brutal final act which kind of saves the film in a sense for me, is largely down to the fact that they've roped him in to basically direct and write and do that last bit of the film. And you can clearly see where that completely changes, and suddenly I won't give any spoilers away, but suddenly the last 20 minutes or so of the film completely changed tone, and you can see that someone else is doing it basically. But it was kind of okay generally. That final act I think saved it from being just a bit of a bore, mostly. But it was okay. It was all right. I wouldn't watch it again particularly. Yeah, it was all right. And with that in mind, I'm going to give it a score of 9 out of 15.
Okay, well, I think that's quite a strong score, to be honest. It's more than half. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go with 12, because I just seem to gravitate toward these long westerns. I loved Rust and that. I forgot what it's called. Horizon, was it? The Kevin Costner one, where you spend so long out in the West and just, you know, growl, and they take their time. And I think I just get geared up for a good long Western. Yeah.
That gives it a score of 21, which puts it in the company of Oxygen, The Arrival, The Hole in the Ground, and about nearly halfway down our leader table. So
The Mist, with Tom Jean as well.
The Mist, yeah. The Opportunists. There's quite a few that have kind of limbered around that kind of mark. About a third, yeah, maybe a third of the way down the list. So there you go.
Yeah. Tom Jean is a fantastic actor. He really is. And I think it needs to be said. I know I'm a huge fan of him, and I always have been, and bring him to the podcast quite a lot. But he is a corker of an actor whenever he gets the right role. I know he ends up in shit with Bruce Willis and stuff like that. But whenever he does something like this, you just get reminded of how good he is. He can be just creepy, slimy, but at the same time, he can be heroic and exciting. You know, it's just a great
actor. Was he the one playing Billy's dad?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know who Thomas Jane was, but he seemed to just be one of the other boring characters. I just didn't think that any of the characters they tried to make Merrick into Clint Eastwood. If anyone, I think the girl, Mary Stickley, was probably the most interesting character of the lot of them. And as you say, William H. Macy was in it for about 2 minutes, right at the beginning, and never seen again. And that Mary Stickley, I'd never heard of her either, and she doesn't seem to have much of a track record of being in much stuff. So I don't know. It just seemed like an odd film. I think they kind of done what they could with it. It'd be really interesting to read the book and see if anyone else has made any film of the book as well.
Yeah, possibly, yes. It is quite a standard story. It is just it's a real character piece about characters who you don't like, so
they're okay. I just wasn't blown away by it, that's all. And as you said, I've given it a half decent score, so I haven't given it a zero by a long stretch. Yeah, it was all right. It was just okay. And I think the finale, as I say, is worth seeing because of that obvious, from what I found out, switch in script and director and what have you for the last 20 minutes. So track it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, then. It's out there to be watched, so watch it, you good people. Right, okay, it's my turn to pick something for the next show, and I'm going to give you a choice. Ooh. Of the 2026 film The Last House, in which a family of four is suddenly sealed inside the house with no way out, and they must work together to survive against their dwindling resources and the mysterious looming threat that's keeping them trapped. So there's that. And the other choice we can possibly look at is the new Ricky Gervais animation, which is now on Netflix. In fact, both of these things are on Netflix currently. They're all out there. And this is this Ricky Gervais thing, Alley Cats, which is about a group of cats, and he's got his usual, I think we spoke about it on the last show, he's got his usual kind of group of known comrades to do the voicing over the life of these cats over six shortish episodes on Netflix. So there's your choice: The Last House or Alley Cats.
All right, I'm going to be controversial here and say both. Because I'm gonna watch them both. I want to see The Last House. My wife wants to see that as well, and I do fancy Alley Cats. So we'll talk about them both. Why not?
There you go. Cool. Right, now next up is theme treats, and it was your turn to choose a theme, and you went for tech based thrillers.
Yes, thrillers that generally have a sort of a technological subtext to them. And I've spoken for far too long on this podcast already, so I'm going to challenge Ted to go first with his first choice.
The first one that I thought of as soon as you said tech-based thrillers was War Games from 1983, a decade where I didn't ever watch any television or see films, I might add. But for some reason, I did watch War Games, and I think I went to see it at the cinema when I was doing my psyche nurse training, and I was transfixed by this story of this kind of techno thriller with Matthew Broderick as a young man, and the way in which he was very interested in hacking. So he hacks into the school's mainframe and does some naughty stuff. But eventually he starts playing this game, and he thinks that it's just a game. But it turns out that he's hacked into the Whopper computer, the War Operation Plan Response computer, and he's into the NORAD nuclear war simulator or something. And he's hacked into this thing. He doesn't know he's hacked into this thing. He suddenly gets various members of the government security agencies tracking him down and finding him. He then goes on the run with his girlfriend, who's played by Ali Sheedy, they head off across the land to get away from this thing. In the end, they hook up with Stephen Falcon, who's played by David Wood. Is that right? Between the three of them, they realize what's going on, and it turns into a way in which the nuclear defense systems and attack systems of the Russians and the Americans are all being controlled by this war game going on. One side thinks that it's happening. The other side thinks it's happening. They're not quite sure between them if stuff is happening or not. And it all turns out that it's back to this game that this snotty oik has been playing in his bedroom. And it ends up in the war room, and Stephen Falcon finds a very clever way to tell both sides' computers that the only way to win is not to play, and that sort of thing. And so it kind of comes to a kind of climax where everyone's going, phew, we got away with it. It didn't blow up the world. So that I just thought that I remember back with that film, and I was thinking to myself, that's a really, really, it was a really good film. I really enjoyed it. And it was kept you on the edge of your seat a lot of the time. And as I say, I don't usually like these 1980s type films, but that one I made an exception for. I guess you know this well.
Yeah. I haven't actually seen it since VHS. No, I haven't. And I keep thinking, was Dabney Coleman not in it? I thought he was in it. Maybe I'm getting confused. Dabney Coleman.
I don't know who that is.
Possibly the finest man who ever lived. He was. He plays.
You've got a long list of those. Under that heading.
It's a quote from Kevin Pollock. Dabney Coleman, possibly the finest man who ever lived, or something like that. I can't remember.
Okay.
But yeah, he's in there, and Barry Corbin as well. Yeah, it's just beautifully 80s.
Yeah, it is.
When you think of the 80s tech thrillers or kid thrillers, this is the pinnacle of them, where they all wanted to be just as good as this. Even things like Flight of the Navigator or that kind of stuff, they all want to be war games, but they never quite managed it. Yeah, this is phenomenal. And I believe that they were going to make a sequel some years later and try to revisit it. And they still could. You know, we still have Broderick. Why not?
I think I said David Wood earlier. It's John Wood, who is a famous British actor who's been in lots of really high-quality films. And was worth checking down as an actor himself. Surprised we didn't do him in our actor section of the themes back in the day, but we didn't seem to do. The second one I come up with, which we have spoken about before, is Colossus, the Forbin Project. And I remember I spoke about this before, and you said, I must watch that. That sounds great. And you hadn't seen it. At least I think it was you. Maybe that was Alan. Anyway, this is a 1970 film with a similar kind of theme, except that it's a sci-fi thriller on the basis of that there's a supercomputer that the Americans create called Colossus, and it takes complete control of the American nuclear arsenal to make sure that there's world peace. But shortly after Colossus has given complete free reign of all data that it can get to, sort of thing, the computer detects that the Russians have got their own version called the Guardian, and so the Colossus wants to talk to Guardian. It wants the Americans to give it direct access to talk to Guardian, so that the two computer systems can join forces and make sure that they make all the right decisions for the people of the world. Sound familiar? AI? Mm-hmm. And so the trouble is that once they were given the means to do this, they basically took over everything, and they made humans obedient to what they were doing, and they were working out that humans were actually not needed any longer, and it is a kind of from 1970 to have this insight into this storyline, which, you know, we're heading ever closer towards at the moment, it was really kind of forward thinking, I suppose. It's largely about humans are not needed. Leave the running of the planet to us, Colossus and Guardian. We'll sort everything out for you, and then eventually we'll annihilate you, because we've worked out that humans are not needed here. Really good, well done film. Very, very terrifying for its day, I think, and very, very chilling when you see where the humans are not given choices, and how they're one example is when him and his wife or his girlfriend have to negotiate space in the house where they're not being under the watchful eye of the Colossus camera to see what they're doing the whole time. And they get an agreement that in the bedroom's all right, which seems unlikely, but anyway, in the bedroom they're able to that's right, the two of them are not husband and wife, but they pretend to be, so that they can go into the bedroom to talk tactics about trying to hold off these things. It's a really, really good film with really forward thinking writing and an insight into what the future will bring in terms of AI, which we're heading towards now. As I say, have you seen it yet?
No, I haven't. I'll line it up. I should have it lined up in my watch list, but I just haven't got around to it.
Okay, and the last one is Humans from 2015, not just because of I want to drool over Gemma Chan, but because it's kind of a tech thriller in similar ways, in a sense, where humans take over the Earth, I'll say that again. So humans create robot servants, which again we are looking at that happening now in the world, particularly out of China, where people's jobs are being taken by these robots. But these are particularly human looking robots, and it's just a very interesting thing that there's a subgroup of the robots who have kind of broken free of the control of humans, and they're trying to then overtake the humans. Very, very similar to what I was just describing. But what I did discover is that I didn't know this until recently, is that this all started with another Swedish original series in 2012 called Real Humans. And I've been watching that. I was able to track it down, and it's a very similar story, but the original Swedish one, I think that they've done it better. Of course, Gemma Chan's not in it, which is a downer, but I think they focused more on the what's going on with the technology behind how these things have been created and how they fit into the world, you know, the coming world view. Whereas Humans tends to be more a thing about a domestic drama, living a life with a robot in your house and it becoming very human, i.e. Gemma Chan. But in this other one, the sex thing, in Humans with Gemma Chan, there's this one kind of sex thing where you can plug a thingy into the back of the robot, and it switches on the sex angle on it, and you can then if you want to use the doll as a sex toy.
Erotic, the sex now, angle.
Now in Real Humans, the Swedish one, they take that even further. And in Real Humans, the Swedish one, there's lots more nudity and sex scenes and stuff. So Humans 2015 with Gemma Chan, they've toned that whole thing down from the original. But if you want to see lots of nudity and sex stuff, then the Swedish one, as you might expect from Sweden, I suppose, is better in that respect. Or worse, if you see it that way. Anyway, there's my little picks.
yeah, good choices. I have to agree. I haven't seen Humans yet, but I would like to. It does sound like a quality TV show, and I will get to Colossus. I think actually Masson will probably enjoy it too. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have two fairly simple ones, pretty foreseeable, I suppose. Sneakers, which is the classic 1992 film with Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd, River Phoenix, David Strathairn, which is it's got a story that revolves around encryption and computer security, surveillance and phone tapping, paranoia and electronic intrusion and things like that. It's a really decent thriller that has a wonderful sense of humor to it. It's thrilling, it's exciting, and it has a lot of neat ideas to it. For example, David Strathairn's character is visually impaired, so he has to do things that just, you know, ramp up the tension a wee bit. And, you know, I think he has to drive the van at some stage, which is kind of fun in that way, and that just makes it a bit more thrilling. Dan Aykroyd in a very non-comedy role, but still being quite humorous. Not a non-comedy role, but a non-comedy film. He suits this quite well. And the way he is really suits the film. He's able to gibber off all these technical terms quite easily, like he does in Ghostbusters and in various different films, and it works quite nicely. I think he's actually underrated for this film as well. River Phoenix is one of his few roles that we managed to get from him, and he's really cool as well. It's nice to see him in any film nowadays. And it's got no CGI, it's got no ridiculous typing, you know, 900 words a minute and lines of code across the screen or something. They use phones and modems and, you know, store-bought or shop-bought microphones and surveillance equipment to do things. And that really separates it from the rest of the kind of technological thrillers. I think it's a real kind of... It was a big hit whenever it came out, and dutifully so. It's somewhat been forgotten about, I'd say, over the years, and maybe because it's dated technology as opposed to modern technology that doesn't really rely on the internet, and it's more kind of modems and that sort of Ethernet sort of connection, FidoNet and all those kinds of protocols, as opposed to hacking websites and things like that, where things just get a bit lazy now, I'd say. So it's very 90s and suits the tech thriller genre very well. Maybe it's just because we're a bit older that it's more appealing now. Have you seen it, Sneakers?
Yeah, I saw it at the cinema, and I haven't seen it since that day in the cinema, which is in the 90s, you said. So 92. So it's been a long time, and I just watched the trailer rolling there, and it was kind of coming back to me, but it's definitely on the watch list now. I like the look of that. Yep.
Yeah, it's very War Games-y along the ways of The right. Conversation and Robert Redford's other film, 3 Days of Condor.
Okay.
Cool. The second one is a real guilty pleasure. Firewall from 2006 with Harrison Ford and Paul Bettany. It's a bad techno thriller. It's a fun Save My Family Harrison Ford movie, if anything. A bit forgettable because he's made better ones, but it's still a decent time, and it's got a good cast with the two leads I mentioned, and then Virginia Madsen's in there, Robert Forrester, Robert Patrick in a fairly showy role, which Alan Arkin is there too. And it just works quite well. The big problem is that the technology of it, and because it's a bank heist movie where he has to decrypt protocols and things like that. It's all window dressing, and it's techno mumbo jumbo that might not actually be real. It's just like, oh, that sounds cool. Put that in there, and that will mean that we know what we're talking about in a techie kind of way. It's nowhere near as effective as Sneakers, but it's just a hostage movie disguised as a technology thriller, and it's pretty good fun for that. It's got a few quite exciting moments, and then a fairly decent action climax with Harrison Ford taking on the terrorists. Well, because that's what we want. have you seen Firewall?
No, I'm just, again, looking at the thing rolling through, it doesn't look as though it's anywhere near as attractive as Sneakers. So I might not bother with this, adding this one to my list, but
Well, I remember going to see this in the cinema, and I was there with my wife, and there was only two other people in the cinema, and they were two rather elderly people, maybe in their late 70s, early 80s. And they had a bag full of brandy balls or something like that with that really crinkly paper. And right. I think their hearing might not have been particularly good because as they uncraveled the crinkly plastic paper to take out the brandy ball, they would, squish it back down again and play with it a wee bit. And that's my main takeaway from the first time I saw this film, because I was getting increasingly frustrated with them because they were so darn noisy. And they weren't kids, so I didn't know what to do. I wasn't going to turn around and pull an Alan Gilday on them. But I did shoot them a couple of glances as to shut up. And I think they were aware that they were making so much noise because their hearing wasn't great. And why they were at the techno thriller like this is beyond me. But it probably is, Harrison Ford. He's one of those good movie stars. Let's go watch his film.
Okay, then. Yeah. So there you go. Firewall Sneakers is my takeaway from this little section. So I should definitely go and watch that for a second time in for the first time this century. And we'll go from there. So that's been techno-based thrillers. Next one is my choice. And as referenced to you from you earlier, I'm going to go with films of two halves. Yeah. Now, examples of that are the ones that you mentioned earlier. But one that leaps out at me, first of all, is Full Metal Jacket. I always thought that that was completely just two different films, and that's a good example if anyone wants to kind of plug into what I'm talking about here. So perhaps we can have a go with that theme, films of two halves. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely, let's do that.
Okay, the main feature, I'll go first, and I would like to bring Nightborne, a 2026 film, and it's a Finnish film, and it is directed by Hanna Bergholm, who also did Hatching. I think you were talking about Hatching at one point. It uses ancient Nordic troll and changeling folklore as a dark allegory for early motherhood and postnatal mental health. So Saidi Hala, who is the main star of the film, she plays Saga alongside her non-Finnish-speaking, because they're in Finland, partner John, played by Robert Grint. This family have relocated from London to Finland, and they're going to stay in her grandmother's knackered forest house. It's in the middle of these loads and loads of trees. And it's... The film is very much centered around the forest and the forest having a life of its own, basically. So it's one of those supernatural kind of films. She gets pregnant, and she has a son who they call Kura. But immediately Saga, mum, senses something's horribly wrong with this Kura child. The child comes out matted in hair. It has a small sprout-like tail. And it keeps biting her nipple and making her bleed when she's breastfeeding it. And so we get lots of kind of body horror stuff going on with that kind of thing as well. So while the doctors kind of dismiss her horror about the whole thing as postnatal depression and that she's imagining things, John, the husband, tries to play it down as well. But Saga knows the truth about this, because she suddenly starts to realise that the reason that the child is biting her nipples is that it's not interested in food. It just wants to eat blood and raw meat. So you can imagine where this is going. There are lots of secrets from the old forest kind of supernatural stuff coming out. And so the film heads into body horror, even cannibalism at one point, and blood-soaked chaos galore, frankly. Saidi Hala is actually really, really good in the central performance as the woman at the middle of all this. And of course, it's got subtitles, unless you can find it dubbed, I suppose. And the husband is very good as well in his kind of British type way. And there's lots of animatronics going on and puppetry rather than CGI. So when this creepy child, it's quite interesting that you don't see its face until the finale. And then suddenly we see all throughout 90% of the film, the face is hidden and you don't see what it is. All you see is that the hairy arm, the hairy back. It's really, really good. It was on Shudder. That's where I saw it. Highly recommended. I won't say anything more about it. And I think that it's a really good romp and a good story, well acted, well produced, and worth tracking down.
That sounds a bit like It's Alive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Demon
okay.
Baby. Yes.
A bit like what was that Noomi Rapace film as well? Lamb. The similar kind of theming to the Lamb film, that's right. My second one is Calvary, which is a 2004 film that you put me onto, I think, and that also is on Shudder. it's completely bonkers. It's about this traveling singer whose van breaks down in the middle of this rainy forest in Ardennes, the Ardennes region in France. So it's all in French and subtitled again. He takes shelter in this isolated inn, come pub, come hotel, and he meets the owner called Paul, who is a retired comedian. And they initially hit it off, and he's delighted to have another performer staying with him, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it turns out that it's much darker than all this, and eventually our main character, Mark, gets trapped and isolated from the world by Paul, and Paul is obviously going a bit nutty, because one of the reasons being that he lost his wife, and he's trying to make someone else be his wife. Bit of a long story. You need to watch it to get the but the bottom line is that he's kind of really unhinged, and when Mark tries to escape this house one day, this inn, he heads into the local village. And this is the funniest bit of the whole film, is that he heads into this village and there's this group of men in this village which are completely wonky, unhinged men, sexually frustrated, it turns out. And so they're all kind of dressing up in strange ways. And there's this really there's this really unforgettable kind of trance-like group dance scene in this pub where I was laughing. I thought it was really funny, but it's just bizarre where all these men start. Some guy gets on the piano, starts to knock out a tune, and they're all dancing. You've got to see this scene to believe how quirky and sinister and dark it is. Really, really interesting. But apparently the director shot this on Super 16 film, and he put a kind of eerie soundtrack to it. So I've discovered since. It's just about a rural community who, through having no women left, because all the women have been frightened away, it would seem, they've just all gone bonkers and they're all unhinged. And this poor bloke that happens to break down in their territory is used as a foil for all their frustrations. So obviously you put me onto it, so you must have seen this. And that was my kind of appraisal of it. Really, really well worth seeing, but completely bonkers. And if nothing else, that dance scene is just really funny.
Right. Well, I have to be honest with you. It was a testing ground, because I was very close to buying it from Arrow. I still have it in my basket, and I wasn't sure whether or not I was going to like it, and I couldn't get around to watching it. So I let you. And also, one of the things I noticed about it is that there is an ex-French porn star in it as well. And I was wondering, how does that work? Brigitte Lahaie.
Mademoiselle Vicky. Who is she then? Mademoiselle Vicky. I don't think she's in it much.
Yeah. But I was thinking, because she's quite highly billed, and I thought, does it go into that area? I know what, I'll get Ted to test it out for me.
You know, I can't even remember her role in it. I think it must have been really small, because most of it is about the men. And it's remarkable, because there is no women in it, really. And I'd forgotten about her.
Okay, well, that's all right. I'll give it a go then in the coming weeks, because it's been one on my watch list for a good long time, and now it's had a good release on Blu-ray. I'll pick it up. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, that's me done. What have you got?
Okay, I'm going to do a really quick one, because I spent most of my time in Flop of the Fortnight. The IT Crowd, I have watched three or four seasons of that, plus the special with my son and my wife recently, because it is just such a funny show, and it's got your bird in it, Gemma Chan. She's in two episodes, I think, actually.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, and it stars Richard Ayoade as Moss, who is the infamous nerd with the haircut and the short trousers and the plaid shirt. Chris O'Dowd as Roy, who is just socially inept in every way and emotionally challenged and all that. And then Catherine Parkinson as Jen, as the kind of the office manager who knows nothing about what computers do or the internet or sending emails
and there's a humans link in there as well, because she's in humans.
Oh, is she? Right, okay. Yeah. Matt Berry and Chris Morris play the Renhams, and I keep thinking, you know, who do I like better? Because it's one then the other. Chris Morris plays Renham in the first season and a wee bit in the second season, and then Matt Berry takes over for the rest of the show. And I'm like, I don't know which one I like better as the boss of the corporation. And they're just so much, they're just so funny, both of them, in every way. Most people will probably prefer Matt Berry, but I still think that Chris Morris gives a really strange performance for the type of comedian that he was. It was weird seeing him turning up on this, but then you realize just how funny this TV show is. It makes sense that he's in it. And then there's the other member of the IT crowd as well, who's in a few episodes, Richmond, that most people forget about, who's the goth, battling the goth disease that he has.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a show that whenever you watch it in sort of close proximity, you realize how many jokes they kind of share between seasons, and they reference other episodes. And I love it when that happens. So many sitcoms ignore that, and it's just like, right, okay, the last one happened. Everyone might have died at the end, but we're all back up and running and everything's going, and we'll just forget about what happened before. Whereas there's running jokes throughout the show, like Moss has a hot ear and he sprays it with a wee thing of cool water to cool it down, and that comes back a couple of times. And then the 999 joke, which everyone loves because they've changed the emergency services number from 999 to 08113157413. And it's just they bring it back, I think, a couple of times throughout the entire show. And the internet, which is a box as opposed to being what it actually is. And it's a great TV series, and written by Graham Lindell, who did Alan Partridge and Black Books. And he is just such a divine wit when it comes to this. I know outside of this his personality does require some warnings, but here he nails the comedy throughout, and it's just exceptionally funny. He has such a good way at conveying just really funny comedy, and I think it's not underappreciated in any way. I think anyone who watches the IT crowd loves the IT crowd, and I imagine you probably have too, and appreciate it greatly, hopefully.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. I'm with you on this. I think it's really funny. And I like Black Books as well. I thought that was it was more kind of quirky. It took me more getting into than the IT crowd. But I thought Black Books was pretty good. But yeah, IT crowd, I'm with you. I've watched it right the way through as well, but not for quite some time. So perhaps it's time to do it again.
I think you should, yeah. It's one of those sitcoms, they don't make them like they used to. And it's almost like this was kind of coming to the end of the great British sitcom. And I can't think of too many that have really held the mantle as well since. And I'm not sure which in order they came, Alan Partridge, IT Crowd, and Black Books. But once they kind of went away, British sitcoms just didn't quite have it anymore. I can't think of any great ones recently.
There's a challenge. We could do a sitcoms since the sitcom from this century, and British sitcom from this century.
Yeah.
It's an idea. Right. Okay. There you go, then. That's the main feature done. Links in the show notes, as always. And now it's time for Coming Soon. What have we got in our selection?
Okay. Well, the first one is Paper Tiger, which is a new film starring, oh, your man, what's his name?
Adam Driver. Yes.
Asshole one. And this is directed by James Gray. And it is about two brothers who pursue the American dream but get entangled in a dangerous Russian mafia scheme that terrorizes their family, testing their bond as betrayal becomes impossible or becomes possible. It's a really good looking, big kind of mafia style thriller that it reminds me a wee bit of like Goodfellas or The Departed or, you know, something Whitey Bulger-esque or something like that. It really looks like a good gangster period drama, and it's got Adam Driver, Scarlett Johansson, Miles Teller, and more. Yeah, what did you think of this?
Yeah, as you know, I'm not one for the kind of mafia style gangster films, but with the cast in this on show, it looks irresistible. Really, as you know, I like Adam Driver, Scarlett Johansson. The two of them are brought back together after the brilliant Marriage Story in 2019, which I banged on about. I did look for a link in terms of director or producer between the two films, but I couldn't find anything. So I'm assuming that that's just a coincidence or whatever, or someone appreciating what they're doing. But yeah, good cast. Not my type of thing, but because of Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, I will certainly watch it. So yeah, like it.
Yeah. Here's another one I think you're really going to love. The Only Pickpocket, or The Only Living Pickpocket in New York, starring John Turturro, Will Price, and Gus Fring.
Yeah.
When a theft goes awry, a veteran pickpocket is sent on a mission through New York to reclaim it. It looks like it reminds me a wee bit of that Adam Sandler film, Uncut Diamonds, a kind of raw backstreet pickpockery with a top-notch performance from John Turturro. And Steve Buscemi's in there as well. Looks really cool. Mm. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I agree. It had Woody Allen. I know it's New York, so it might be bound. I might be bound to say this, but it had kind of Woody Allen vibes about it, I thought. But it's a really good cast, and I thought it had a bit of comedy, but also it seemed very dark and potentially moving as well. There was one scene in the trailer where it looked as though it was kind of heading towards being a bit of a moving, emotional storyline. But yeah, the cast is great. That bloke in the lead is the guy from Severance, isn't he? What's his name?
John Turturro.
Yeah. Isn't it Severance? Yeah.
Yeah, he was in Severance, yeah.
Yeah. I thought he was. But yeah, I'm all over this one. Good choice.
Barton Fink and things like that. The Coens use him quite a lot.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Next up is a TV series that's coming to Apple TV on September 9th. So those two previous ones were coming to the cinema, by the way. This is a 6-episode TV show called Last Scene, about a police dispatcher. Where have we heard that before? Ian Ridley's daughter, Maggie, disappeared years ago. He receives a call, believing it's her. He embarks on a relentless quest to find her and reunite his family disregarding consequences. This looks like a pretty darn good, family thriller, mystery thriller type thing, with a reuniting a broken family, with tense, exciting sequences as he digs deeper in the corruption and it goes all the way to the top, as Alan would say. What did you make of this?
Well, the genre has been done so many times before, but I think we can trust Apple TV to make it kind of different and special. So it does look well produced from the trailer. And yeah, good looking little thriller. So I think that might be very good as well.
Yeah. Okay. Josephine, this is the next one. And I can't remember watching the trailer, come to think of it, but it stars Channing Tatum, your bird Gemma Chan again. And it's about an 8-year-old Josephine who accidentally witnesses a crime in Golden Gate Park. Oh, yes, I remember this now. She acts out in search of a way to regain control of her safety while adults are helping her, are helpless to console her. This is rated 18. That makes me think that it's going to be quite savage. What did you make of this?
Well, I couldn't quite 100% work out what was going on, to be honest. And it was this thing was staged as a teaser rather than a trailer. So perhaps that was the general idea. But I, as you know, Gemma Chan's enough for me to drop everything and watch it, including my trousers. And
oh, good grief. But both of the listeners have just turned off.
It looks like it's very well shot, very well acted, and that little girl in the lead role looks as though she's very well a good actor as well. No idea who it is, but it does look like it's another one for when's that coming?
It's Mason Reeves is the child actor, and this is her first film.
Okay, so, but anyway, it does look good. I do like the look of it. Yes. Yeah.
There's no release date yet, but the teaser is on YouTube, and you can watch it thusly.
Yep.
They've all been really good films or good-looking projects so far, so let's keep that up, will we? Because Jurassic Rampage is arriving from Asylum. But to be honest, and I know that all the money shots are in the trailer, it actually looks quite good in a dinosaurs transported by armored truck escape and to a nearby neighborhood, and the family trapped there must survive the deadly onslaught kind of way. And obviously, this is timed for the end of Oak Street or whatever that film's called, and it's the Asylum knockoff version of that, but they've decided to go with Jurassic instead as their cash in name. Uh-huh. But you know, sometimes I am really hopeful that one of these films is just going to do the business and be quite good. And the special effects in this actually look fairly decent, to be honest. What did you make of it?
It's a shame that the bikini-clad babe running around, bouncing about, kind of spoiled the... It made it look like a cheap kind of, American comedy almost. But apart from that, yeah, it looks really good fun. It looks like an interesting idea. And as always, it just depends on how well it's been done or if it's setting itself out to be just a bit of fun and not to be taken seriously. It's a Friday night after the pub kind of film by the looks of it, but yeah, I like the look of it. Why not?
There you go, Asylum. There's a quote for the back of the box. Fantastic. Right, well, that brings it to the end.
Indeed. But before we go, there is the final curtain full of people I don't know. I know one of them, but yes, lead us through people that have not made it through the last fortnight.
Okay, well, there is tragic news on this show that we have lost Reggie Bannister, who meant a lot to me because I'm a massive fan of the Phantasm franchise, and he was a pinnacle part of that, playing the character of Reggie, the lovable ice cream man turned action hero, and that is huge four tube shotgun that he uses to blast away the tall man whenever he gets the opportunity. Phantasm is a really, really good series of films. I know some people will go, because of its low budget origins and its independent feel and things like that. But I think as a franchise, it just works really well for what they're trying to achieve. And Don Coscarelli should receive a huge amount of applause for the five films that he managed to put out against the odds. And he has a great cast led by Reggie Bannister for each of the films. He's in a ton of other movies, including Wishmaster and Bubba Ho-Tep and Silent Night, Deadly Night 4. Those are the ones I can think of, but he made a bunch of other films as well that were, you know, kind of fan picks where people would really enjoy seeing him on screen whenever he turned up, and he was a bit of a get for some of the smaller independent films that he appeared in, like Spring Break Massacre or or 2006 Fallen Angels, not the other one with Jeff A. And Carnies, that's right. He was in Carnies. I forgot about that. Yeah. Not Another B Movie as well is one of those ones. Bloody Bloody Bible Camp. That sounds pretty darn good. I'll be all over that. I think, Ted, you'd like that too, maybe. Looks cheap and nasty. Zombie Family, which is a TV series he had an episode of. Stormageddon, Earthquake versus Tsunami. That sounds like a particularly difficult to shoot film on a limited budget, but he's there too. And he still has one film that's coming called Halloween Ghouls, which I imagine that's a real challenge for him to film. Or it's been sitting maybe on the shelf for a while. But the way in which he passed was quite saddened because he unfortunately had Lewy body dementia and Parkinson's. And there was a wee bit of a GoFundMe earlier in the year to try and help pay for some of the medical costs. Because it was just, you know, it's one of those killers in the American medical situations where you just maybe don't have enough funds to be able to carry on with treatment, or treatment becomes difficult, or not all of it is covered by insurance and things. So he passed away at the age of 80. I'm guessing you're a bit of a Reggie Bannister amateur then?
I've never heard of him. And all of those films that you just read out, I've not seen any of them, and I don't recognize his face. And I've looked through his list of credits myself, and I've not seen anything of it at all. Sorry.
No worries. It happens. Next up is Vincent Pastore, who Sopranos fans will be beside themselves because Big Pussy has passed away. He's also in Carlito's Way and Shark Tale, Revolver. And he was well known for playing that kind of mafioso heavyweight. So I don't expect, Ted, you would know him particularly well.
I've seen Carlito's Way, but I saw it in the cinema when it came out. And I can remember when I was there really not liking it. I was taken along to watch it by a friend of mine, said, "Oh, we've got to go and watch this." And I just thought it was all, I just didn't like it at all. I did notice from his credits that he was in Manhattan Murder Mystery, Woody Allen's film from 93. But unfortunately, it was Man in Restaurant, uncredited. I was looking through the list of credits to see what I watched, and there was just Manhattan Murder Mystery was the only one apart from Carlito's Way. So, and again, I don't really recognize him. So anyway, back to you.
Well, I've seen him in Riding Cars with Boys with Drew Barrymore and James Woods. That was a particularly good one. And then Denzel Washington's The Hurricane, the boxing drama. The Last Dawn, actually. That was John Mant, I know, if memory serves. And Night Falls on Manhattan. That's right. I don't remember him in that, but he plays Cop 3 in that, so it must be a starter outer kind of small role that he had. But he became I'd say a bit of a household name thanks to The Sopranos, and very recognizable for it. He still has 11 films that are due for release.
Wow. Good
and great. And he passed away at the age of 80, which is very sad, but quite the presence and quite the look. Yeah.
Eight, 80 seems to be the age of the week, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, because similarly, the Northern Irish comedian, not so much a movie star, but he's well known from the TV and pantomime circuit, Jimmy Cricket has passed away. I'm throwing this in because I remember seeing him live in pantomime whenever I was quite young. He played something in one of the things I went to see in the Grand Opera House in Belfast. But he was from Cookstown in County Tyrone here in Northern Ireland. And he was just a very funny man, one of the ones that managed to make it. And he became a well-known name alongside the likes of Frankie Carson and the Crankies and Cannon and Ball of that sort of Saturday night TV fame. And you don't remember him at all, no?
Cannon and Ball, did you say? Was he part of that?
No, he would appear in things like that, you know. And
oh, okay.
He probably appeared on maybe a couple of episodes of their TV show or whatever. He was that.
I think, again, I'm the wrong age, because I do remember the Crankies being around and finding, whenever I bumped into them on the television, finding them really annoying. But they were part of children's TV, I seem to remember, like Saturday morning telly programs, and the Crankies would turn up. Is that right?
Sort of, yeah. There's a picture of him on IMDb alongside Rod Hull, isn't it? I can't remember his name. And it's that kind of a British variety act that would pop up, or Noel Edmonds and things like that would have him on.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on, do a wee bit and be funny and entertain the crowds.
Yeah.
Passed away at the age of 80.
At least I've heard of him.
Well, yes. The last one, I don't expect you to have heard of, because you might not be of the Dukes of Hazzard ethos, but Ben Jones has passed away, who played Cooter in Dukes of Hazzard. He passed away at the age of 84. He didn't have an extensive career outside of the Dukes of Hazzard, but he was just that familiar face. That was the mechanic who helped work on their car and fix their car and things like that, and he drove Cooter's truck. I remember having Cooter's truck when I was a kid. I always liked Cooter. I think he was my favorite character out of Dukes of Hazzard, which some people will go, what, why? But I can't remember why. I haven't seen Dukes of Hazzard in a long time. But Cooter was the one that I would play in the playground when we were playing Dukes of Hazzard. It was one of those things. But he also appeared in the John Travolta legal drama Primary Colors. And the TV show Sliders, and a couple of other films over the years, but he didn't have a huge career. I think one of his big breakouts came from, you know, being that Burt Reynolds style good old boy thing in the movie Moonrunners, and he also had an uncredited bit in Smokey and the Bandit as well. So he was that kind of moonshine runner, good old boy that was really popular on TV during the late 70s, early 80s. And that was the perfect thing for him to play in the Dukes of Hazzard TV series. You're not aware of him, no?
No, sorry. Completely lost on me. And I did watch the Dukes of Hazzard, you know, off and on. I wasn't a huge fan watching it every week, but I did. And if you told me the four most... the four main characters, say, in the Dukes of Hazzard, I would know them, but I looked at this guy's character in it and it didn't ring any bells at all. So no, I'm sorry, yet again, someone I don't know.
Unacceptable, Ted, unacceptable. You must go out and watch everything that they have ever done. No.
Anyway, there you go. That's Flop of the Fortnight. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. In fact, now, a little bit less than 2 weeks' time, with another show. And we'll hopefully you'll join us then and listen to us again nattering on about film, cinema and TV. GarethMiles.com is where you can find Gareth's stuff. PodHub UK is where you can find most of the other stuff we do. ProjectorRoom.co.uk is our website. And if you get lost, you can head for TedSalmon.com, where you can find everything that I do, we do, the team does, in terms of podcasts and links to all of our MeWe groups. So there you go. Have a good fortnight, everyone, and hopefully you'll join us next time in the Projector Room. Thank you.